WNST, Joss in Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive, keeping calm, staying local, and first things first here, Don Moeller is with us. We want to say hello to all of our sponsors. We're going to get back, and this guy is a veteran to our sponsors. I think we had him out at Jennings Cafe for a burger one day and a salad back last summer. He's also been a visitor here, but next time we get together, we're going to take him down to Faithy's, get some crab cakes, and do it up all proper down at Lexington Market. You could still ship those crab cakes anywhere in the world. State Fair still with us. I was out there last week for some chicken and waffles, and I'm going to get back for some shrimp and grits. Evan is opening a Mexican restaurant. I don't know the name of it yet, but it's across the street on Frederick Road. We're getting that ready. And also social distancing very, very much in play now that we're in the phase two at State Fair, Frederick Road in Catonsville. And Don, I'm going to tell you that I had a little problem on Wednesday night. And I know Reverend Al's going to think this is a first world problem, but I got a lot of Taharka ice cream here. They're one of our great sponsors. And I could not find a cone in my house on Wednesday night. This was tremendously disappointing to me. So sometime between now and 8 p.m. when I have my traditional sunset cone here, I'm going to have to go get some cones tonight, Don.
I'm betting that our guest today, Reverend Al Hathaway, probably has had a little Taharka ice cream along the way.
I would hope so.
Wager on that. Oh, you know that. You know, I've had them come to the church. And I've had what they call ice cream sundae. So yes, they are an amazing business and an amazing
Baltimore story.
An amazing ice cream.
Well, there you go.
I tell people, Nestor. I thought Nestor was building it up too much because they were a sponsor. We're proud to have them, and I thought, well, I'm sure it's going to be okay. But it ice cream is ice cream, and you probably agree with me, Rev. It might be the best ice cream I've ever had in my life. I've never had anything quite so good.
Well, let me give you an example. So I have what they call ice cream sundae. So on ice cream sundae, it's basically for the kids of the church, the youth of the church. Man, I have more adults there. They want nuts on it.
It's like Halloween, right? When you go out and you take all the candy when you're an adult, right?
Oh. Exactly. And they are amazing. Then I have a kind of like a summer health fair. They come there and bring their trucks, and they bring their truck there, and they're giving ice cream to the people in the community. They are an amazing business and an amazing ice cream.
Can I read from the back of the carton here, Don? I don't know if you've read this or not, but I'm going to read it out loud because it's perfect for Reverend. At Taharka, we use our award-winning ice cream to serve up social change. Each scoop inspires cultural understanding, community engagement, economic empowerment, and, of course, good times. Our social enterprise is managed and operated primarily by young adults who are bringing change to our beloved city. Ice cream has always inspired people to come together, so we take ours to the intersections of cultural divides to do just that. Taharka is an authentic ice cream experience that only Baltimore can offer, but luckily, everyone, including Reverend Al over at Union Baptist Church, can enjoy. Rev, welcome back. I mean, I wish we were welcoming you back and say, you know what, all the things you talk about in God's kingdom has come here, and it's all perfect, and nobody's marching in the street, and we got a perfect president, we got a perfect everything. Boy, we got a mess on our hands, and I know Don reached to you this week to talk about more of these issues, some of that are on the carton of my Taharka ice cream here. I caught a group, and I don't know if it was your group, it was a community group on Tuesday night, and I live high up downtown, and I looked down, I had my windows open, it's a beautiful night, and I heard the chanting coming, and it wasn't, there were a lot more protests and marches on Sunday and Monday, but Tuesday night was quiet, about 8 o'clock, and I looked out, and I got my binoculars, because I rarely do that, but I grabbed them from my cat where she usually perches, and I looked down. And it was just the most beautiful thing, Rev. I mean, it was maybe 250, 300 people, mostly African-American, but all shapes and sizes. I mean, five-year-old little girls in pigtails with their moms and holding hands. And you could tell it was aunts and uncles and grandparents. Some folks were in wheelchairs. Some folks were on bikes. Some folks brought their skateboards. And it was a peaceful march through the city. And I looked out, and I listened, and I heard. And Rev, it brought a tear to my eye, and I thought to myself, why are we still doing this? I mean, it's beautiful. It's beautiful for what it is, but it's so ugly for what we've been through that we're still doing this,
Yeah. You know, one of the challenges is that it seems that every era, every generation has its moment. And I believe that this is the moment for that millennial generation. Many of them heard about the struggles. Many of them have responded to injustice, police brutality. But now, this is the time to come together, and I believe that this is their moment. this moment should activate all of us in our society.
Well, I thought about every child that I looked down, and I thought, they're going to remember this the rest. I mean, you know, that was the power for me. The power for me is, how is that 5 or 6-year-old girl, how are we going to make this city better so that 10 years from now, when she's a sophomore in high school, we've got a better city, we've got a better everything. I guess that's what the election was about. Don, I'll let you come in at this point, because
you know, Nestor and I are two white guys, Reverend. And as I said, the reason we wanted to have these discussions this week and really try to talk from the heart about race is, please weigh in on this. I don't think, even in 2020, we have the really hard discussions about race across racial lines. Oh, are we truly honest? Are we opening up? Are we really trying to explore what in the heck is happening and not happening in our country? As one of our real faith-based leaders in the city, what do you think about our ability to have these dialogues?
Yeah, you know, one of the challenges, and I'll point directly to the school system. When I merged to the Baltimore City Public School System many moons ago, it was a very diverse school system. So I was interacting with people from all over, from different communities, my friends that had Greek origin, my friends that had Polish origin, my friends that were white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, Asian Americans. You had all of that. It was a cosmopolitan of the city. But the city has changed, and as a result of the city changing, we don't have the opportunity to have those kinds of relationships and conversations in the development phase. So we are delaying the conversation because our public educational system is fundamentally and basically segregated. And so what, how do we create civic engagement? How do we create the kinds of conversations? How do we realize that when you hurt, I hurt, when you bleed, that my blood is like your blood? How do you learn that? You learn that in the early stages of your childhood and teenage development. And in Baltimore, we are missing that opportunity because of our school system. That's one phase of it. I can go to another phase of it. Another phase of it is that because we are so hierarchically organized, you have systems and classes of people that never engage with one another. And I would argue because our educational system is so polarized and so segregated.
Well, that's what I wonder. And let's build out on that, Reverend, if we can, because one of my thoughts, and you've alluded to it, you said this might be the moment. One of my thoughts is that, and we won't know. We won't know for months, maybe years, but the killing of George Floyd, the murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, there for everyone to see, seems to me, it's so horrific that it might be one of those moments in history that really does get the attention of people who would prefer not to address things like this. What has been your sense in the days since and weeks since George Floyd has been murdered, what you see happening in our nation?
Yeah, yeah. You know, in my growing up and development, it was the murder of Emmett Till that galvanized the movement, galvanized and sensitized people to the hurt, harm, and pain. There's been a number of incidences of police brutality and persons dying by the hands of the thief, but this was so violent. This was so... See, in this instance, no one could say, hey, wait a minute, you didn't do something, that you resisted or you fought back or disruptive. This gentleman was laying on the ground, handcuffed, and you had this authority figure, which was a police officer, sit there with his neck, and it was literally like a hanging. So it was a public hanging of an African-American male that for 9 minutes, with no response from those who were supposed to protect and serve, it was such a crystallization of brutality that no one could endorse it, no one could support it. Everyone had to say that is repulsive. That moment is creating conversations in the corporate community where they're saying, wait a minute, Are we not being conscious of race? Are we not realizing that there are structural problems where a black child would go and say, I'm afraid to interact with the police, where a white child would say, hey, that's there, he's there to protect me? I think that, this is the moment. Last night I was with faith leaders all across the spectrum there in downtown, right across from the police station. And we had 9 prayers and then 9 minutes of silence. And it was a galvanizing moment, because just as we was doing that, there were protesters that made the turn from Fayette Street to President Street. And it was right in the moment where we were praying as a faith community, and right at the moment when young people were protesting, and now we have prayers, protests, and progress can happen out of this moment.
Well, you talk about the need to come together and the need to make some sense out of all of this. Again, people turn to you for wisdom in these moments. What, as someone who's been around for a while, I mean, you're not a millennial, you're not a 20 or 30 year old. What you talked about Emmett Till, you're a parent. Talk about being an African American parent in 2020, and here again, this keeps happening. It's not the first time. We have Tavon Martin. We have Eric Garner. We can go down the list. Talk about being the parent of an African-American child and what you say to your children and what you say to grandchildren. What do you say to your young parishioners?
You know, one of the most difficult conversations in every African-American, my nephew, 21 years old, just left. He graduated from North Carolina A&T. He lives here in Baltimore. He just left to go to Fort Worth, Texas. And I had to have the conversation with him. My son lives in Dallas, Texas. I have a number of the young men in our church that have gone on from our prostitute go. And for each one of them, I've had the conversation. Everybody understands in the African-American community that this conversation you have, particularly with your African-American males, you say to them that anytime you are confronted by police, show your hands, make sure you have your identification, be respectful, no sir. You know, it's to be deferential to the authority, because you don't know how that person might respond. And it is really tough to think that you have to have this conversation. When I grew up, it was officer friendly. But now I've got to have a conversation with young males around be cautious of your interaction with the police, because the police, at any moment, it could be triggered and you could be a victim. That's a difficult conversation. The other part of the conversation, that is difficult is that if the officer is white, be extremely cautious. That's a tough one.
Reverend, I want to ask you about this. Since Freddie Gray, we 5 years here, and we you know, again, he calls me white. I'm actually Latin from Dundalk, you know, and I would ask you, the last 5 years, we hear so much about police, and we've talked to Police Commissioner Harrison about this and recruiting. Young officer comes on the force, and they're wherever, Southwest, wherever they would be in the city, they come out and they're going to engage into the community. Has any part of that gotten better over the last 5 years to your eye and your congregation on the streets, people you serve, people you keep in your ear in various places in the city? Has it gotten better with the last 3, 4, 5 years? Is it trending better or trending worse locally? Not Minnesota, not in other places, certainly what we've seen in New York and in the protest situations, but on the streets of Baltimore during the last, certainly during this unrest we've had the last week, where we have people marching through the streets, does it feel like the police are trying, or the people that the citizens feel like it's maybe getting a little better, it's trending in the right way? Maybe Sheila, maybe new mayor can help.
I would say to you that that I am deeply embedded in the process of police-community relations. You may know, you may be aware that I created at our church a police lounge. So we took a portion of our campus, and this is a lounge for the police right there on Dolphin Street where they can come, they can relax, they can write their reports. There's a restroom facility, there's water for them, and the people in the community see them going in and out of the church as well as they interact with people in the community.
And now they're not afraid of them as much, yeah?
Exactly, not afraid of them. Here's the point. Here's the thing.
That's beautiful.
Here's the thing that I think is a little different. Slightly different, under the previous administration, we had a community relations division. So you had officers who it was their job to go out and engage with the community in a very real way. And those names people knew, a Melvin, a Charles Lee. You could just go down the list of these officers that were known. Well, then when we made the change from the perspective of Commissioner Harrison, he changed that division and made the proclamation that every officer inside of the police department should be a community engager, engage in the community. The challenge is that as he came about, boom, you had this gun task force, which showed and demonstrated that there were some officers in the department that had ill will towards the community and in many ways were preying on the community. That was a big hit because the personalities of the police officers now are not really known in the community. You see them, but the community doesn't know their names. And that we've got to get to a point where you have, I believe, not the idea of community engagement, but real community engagement where you know the names of the officers and the officers know your name. I tell you this one piece, and I appreciate the fact that I've grown and I've matured in Baltimore City, so I've lived other parts of the world. When I was a child, there was a name that everybody knew, and the name was Officer Murdoch. If you were in Cherry Hill, if you were in West Baltimore, everybody knew the name of Officer Murdoch. Anybody from my era would tell you, man, Officer Murdoch was a great guy. Why was he a great guy? He was a great guy because the first thing that he did when he engaged you, he asked you what was your name, and he wanted them to befriend you, and he wanted to show you how civic engagement and your participation as a citizen is a part of your rights. He never policed. I never knew a time that he actually ever pulled his gun out. He never pulled out his baton. He would always talk to you. And it's taught because he was an authority figure, had impact on us as young people growing up in the city. That's what we need from the police department now. We need authority figures that become your friend.
All right. Do you feel like in your way there that you're raising young police officers maybe one day that would be a line of work? That all the integrity, all the things we would want, we talk about we want inclusive policing. Part of that is for us to educate young people and have people that aspire to that, right? And that's a job that you want to have, not something you don't want to be.
Well, yeah, I have one of the young men in my church that I literally raised over the last 15 years or so with the Canine Corps. Man, he loved dogs, and it was a natural transition for him to go into the Canine Corps. And man, and I see him, he's out running, he's in physical health, and just as happy and excited to be that he's now in a professional way working with dogs that he loves. I mean, I think we can communicate the value of being in the public safety of field and do it in a way that it is not regressive or aggressive, that it is complementary to the goals of our society.
We always love our chats with Reverend Alvin Hathaway. You can find him out at UnionBaptistMD.org. You can find him downtown. You can find him all around. If you get up early enough, you might find him at Clifton Park, or Carroll Park, shooting nine over on the southwest side of town. I want to ask you this because we don't know who the next mayor is going to be, and obviously it's an election thing, and Don's going to lose the gray hair he's got if this election, we don't get a real winner and some clarity on what's happened over in the first district as well. But for you, the new mayor, the next mayor, Sheila, who I'm sure you know, if it is Sheila, what can the next mayor do for you? I mean, you've had political cause in so many of your constituents. I remember last time he gave me some number like 78% of people wanted something that wasn't Sheila or Brandon or anybody currently in city government because of the corruption in all parts of that.
Yeah. As you know, I began an entity called Act Now Baltimore. Act Now Baltimore ended up with over 16,000 people who had registered, taken our survey, and participated in that process. One of the things they were clear on, they wanted a new leader with new direction. Now, one of the challenges, whoever it is, whoever may be the winner, they're gonna emerge out of the Democratic primary with only less than 30% of the vote. So there's 70% of the people that will have not voted for that particular candidate. Now,
I keep telling Don Mueller that. Don, he's saying he's reading my script.
I was gonna say, I think he is. So one of the things that's gonna have to happen is that, and I believe this is the responsibility of the community. We have to say that we want to participate in governance, and that 70% that may feel as though they're outside of the system, we've got to make sure that they have a way to participate in the system so that that minority in terms of the electorate does not feel as though that they are overly inundated with criticism so that they can't do their job. Whoever it is, we've got to make certain that they do the job that's for the best for the people and the citizens of Baltimore City. And that means that there's going to have to be literally all hands on deck.
Are your numbers up? Don, I know you want to move. Are the numbers up? Because the last time we had you, I don't think you had that many. I think you only had a couple thousand.
Oh, you're right. It's been growing because what has happened, this is what happened. First, I had 10 people on the street actually engaging and talking to people. Then we had COVID-19. I had to then go to social media. It caught fire in social media because social media is the communicative means of this era and this generation.
It is. So 16,000 people, what did it tell you? Last time you quoted a number, of those, how many of those 16,000, once you got to that number, which is more substantial than even Malia Cromer, Don?
It's a huge subset.
It's a huge sample. What did you learn statistically from that, and is it available?
If you go to actnowbaltimore.org.
I'm on it right now. Hold on. Don, I'm going to read you some stats. You want me to read you some stuff?
Yes, go ahead.
Do you believe we could do a better job of keeping our city clean and improving infrastructure? Don, 89%.
Right.
Do you believe elected officials should be required to be 100% transparent and accountable? 87%. Do you think Baltimore City is getting worse? 72% said yes.
Right.
This is incredible. So I thank you very much. I'm glad I got an update from you, Rev.
Nestor, that leads me to my point for the Reverend. Nestor and I did a segment recently, Rev, where we talked. I like to say I think I'm mellower the older I get. So I don't get as outraged as often as I used to. I leave that to Nestor. But my head was literally exploding over the fact that we can't count votes in an election. I find it reprehensible. I find it actually to be an affront to the people of Baltimore City and the candidates. I think it's dismissive of democracy. I could go on and on and on. And he has. It really does infuriate me because I think it gets to the core of our democracy. So I'm curious your take and what Act Now Baltimore can make sure to do that this never happens again.
Well, I have to applaud, I believe, the Lieutenant Boyd Rutherford. I think it was bold in his statement that for a person that's been in office now for 20-some years plus, maybe your time is has passed, and maybe we need a new person at the state level that runs our board of election supervisors. I think also when you find that you've had a long-standing person in terms of our local Baltimore City Board, good person, know them well, I think it's time for them to retire. I think we have to have new energy, a new direction, and new leadership there. One of the challenges that you saw, and you know the election process, it was unfortunate and tragic that they did not do something so simple as enforce the electioneering laws. How is it possible that you could have candidates, you could have campaigns in a space with voters when they're going to vote?
Right. Yeah. I don't get it. Rev, there's so much I don't get. I don't get how, and I haven't gotten a good answer yet, and hopefully your group can help get one. I said to Nestor earlier, I think this is an all-hands-on-deck moment. I think it's federal officials.
It is.
Local officials, community activists. I want to know, for example, who, and I don't want the finger pointing from the vendor who was supposed to print the ballots versus the board. I want to know how a ballot went out that was incorrect without being proofread 2, 3, 4, 5 times. I want to know who did that and who's responsible for that.
Right, right. I think this part of accountability, credibility, and transparency was not only about the political leadership, it was also about the political process. And so we are raising those questions about the political process because the process of voting has to be sacrosanct. That has to be without pristine clear. There has to be no questions about the credibility and transparency of that. And now we have so many questions that one would say that whomever comes out is going to be contested by those that may lose.
Reverend, I voted, I don't know about you, I voted 14 or 15 days ago. Nestor and I, as an exercise today, went on to see where our votes were. Now, he voted recently. Having voted 14 or 15 days ago, according to the state website, I'm not sure my ballot has been counted yet. There's no excuse for that.
I did the same thing. I went on myself and looked, and I said, I got no reaction. Nothing told me from the state that my vote had been counted as
correct.
Well. And I did it as soon as I got it in. I said
so
that.
Yeah, I'm checking right now just to update, you know, because I've gone back a couple times just like checking my status to say, you know, is my vote going to count? And they always say, yeah, I'm still here. Ballots sent. And my wife had ballots sent as well. And, you know, we sent them
that doesn't
7 days
mean
ago.
Anything. So something is not right, Reverend. And we had the most important election of our lifetimes. Not, as I say over and over, it's not an exaggeration. November 3rd will decide which direction this nation is headed into.
Well, and the crooked election plays right into his dance card, right?
Yes, yes, yes. If you think about it, it's in our experience that we had in Florida a hanging chart.
Right.
You remember that?
Oh, very well.
Exactly. So in Baltimore, we're having missing ballots, mistaking ballots. It's the same song, but we should be not singing from that sheet music anymore.
Well, it's 2 days after when we're recording this, and it'll play for the next week or so. But as we're recording it, we're several days after the election, and I can't, if based on what I'm looking at, Reverend, unless you're looking at something different, it looks to me that there still are about half of the ballots to be counted.
Yes, and here's the problem. If you think about it, in 2016, when we had our last election, that election was run so poorly that the state did not certify that election.
Right.
We're at a potential situation where 4 years later, we may have the similar same circumstances where the state will be hard-pressed to certify what went on in Baltimore City. That should tell us something. That should tell us that that system needs to change, and heads need to roll.
Well, and it looks like, unless I'm misreading the tea leaves, it looks to me as if they're going to have to totally re-vote in the first city council district.
Exactly.
Right.
Can you imagine that?
An entire district where you're going to have to say to people, I'm sorry, you have to vote again. I mean, it's reprehensible. It cannot happen again. So I think we beat that horse. Let me shift to you, Reverend, for another question. The other night when you watched the President of the United States order the military to shoot rubber bullets and tear gas into a crowd of peaceful protesters, you're a veteran of the civil rights movement. You've been in many, many peaceful protests over the years. What was your thought as an American, as a pastor, when you see the president head to a church and hold a Bible upside down? You've got so much to bring to that. What was your thought on that?
You know, it is so unfortunate that, you know, all of my training, all of my civic lessons says that you hold in esteem the office of the president. The office of president is important and significant to our organization, our structure of a government. We have the legislative branch, you have the judicial branch, and you have the presidency. But to think that there's an occupant in that office that every action, every tweet, every word, everything that they do demeans the office is so distasteful that I cannot wait to the day that that taste is eliminated from my mouth. And to think, and I have Episcopal friends, the bishop here in Baltimore, first African-American bishop of the Episcopal Church. His colleague was the bishop in D.C. The Episcopal Church is totally incensed that the church was used as a backdrop for a photo op.
I mean, it's just, as a man of the cloth, it just seems to go against every bit of religious training, religious philosophy.
Well, and then to come and not read from the Bible, correct? Or to not have a passage. Right, Rev, what do you think when you hear him interviewed about Old Testament and New Testament and clearly has no familiarity with anything in the book?
It's very difficult to think that when you have every president has had familiarity with Scripture. You read Abraham Lincoln and you see his references to Scripture. You think of all of these amazing personalities that use Scripture to guide them as a moral compass. And to think that we have a person in the office that does not use Scripture, does not understand Scripture, cannot think 2 Corinthians is 2 Corinthians. You have to realize that is there a moral compass that guides his actions and activities? I think that as a person of faith, there's a Scripture. God is not easily mocked. God is not easily mocked. I think that he will find that the mocking of God is, in my faith tradition, blasphemous. And when you have blasphemy in my faith tradition, there is no relief from God for that. So I think that he's a person that at some point in his life, he's going to meet the authority that is above on high, and he's going to have to give account for everything that he has done.
Well, Reverend, I know we're running up against the clock here. One of the things, and I appreciate, again, you sitting down out of your busy schedule, one of the topics that Nestor and I have been trying to do a deep dive into this week is this whole issue of white privilege. And I think, again, the death of George Floyd, the death of Aubrey Ahmaud, go right down the list. Again, families are trying to have discussions about what white privilege is and how we use that to become better folks ourselves. What do you say to folks if they say to you, Rev, tell me what white privilege is all about?
You know, one of the things that we've got to realize, and this is Baltimore, because Baltimore is an amazing, amazing city with an amazing history, but it also has an underside. And the underside is that it was the place that spawned this eugenics movement, where you had the Woodrow Wilsons, you had the William Marbury, you had these persons who structurally felt that they had power and privilege because of their ethnicity. And so I think that when we just look at how Baltimore has evolved, I think then we can deconstruct that. And I think now we need to realize that when you think about the B&O Railroad and all that entailed and all that happened there with all the financing and all the land grabbing and all of that, when you think about these institutions that emerged, and out of these institutions came the kind of privilege and lifestyle where persons of color basically were just seen as servants. Now, how do you change that around? How do you have a person realize that you've got to give up white privilege so that we can participate equally in the economic, social, and academic benefits of our culture and society? I tell you this, I will say this. On a personal note, I've found persons in Baltimore, and I move among a lot of people, I've not found the hard, racist attitudes that were in my youth. Baltimore has changed. Society has changed. The problem is that the structures through which we operate has a bias to white privilege. so that a person going for a job, because you have gone to Johns Hopkins over against maybe going to a Morgan State University, it's seen that your resume is more of greater value. We've got to change that.
Rev, I appreciate you, as always, making time for us. We're going to circle back with you and certainly talk about whenever the election result happens, and certainly you know, hope that things get a little more quiet. What is your wish for all of this? A parting shot on all of this. Obviously, you've been politically active. Obviously, Don and I, every fiber of my being will be trying to remove this man from the presidency between now and November 3rd. I've made it a life commitment along with other things, but that's how I feel about being trapped in the home for 3 months with a mask on and watching protests on my street, watching journalists be beaten, watching the President of the United States ordering gassing of our citizens outside the gates of the White House, the People's House, all of that. Your wish for the next time we get together, hopefully it's sooner than later, but a month, 2 months, 3 months from now, where's this going, Rev?
Well, I believe that if we're going to have a healthy Baltimore, one of the areas that has been underinvested has been areas of West Baltimore. I would pray and I would hope that we start to see increased investment going into the underserved areas of West Baltimore.
What would that mean for you? Invest? I bring you $1 billion. Where are you putting it? Where would that go?
Okay, this is what it would do. One, it would be the complete rebuilding and renovation of McCullough Homes, the complete rebuilding and renovation of Gilmore Homes, the complete rebuild and renovation of Poe Homes. We should not have concentrated poverty in Baltimore City.
Fair enough. Well,
there's a good place.
That's it.
To start.
Rev, really appreciate you. Thanks so much. We're going to send everybody out. Can they still take your survey or at Act Now? Is that still available?
Yeah, they can still go on there. They can still go on there and take it. Yes, they can.
It's Act Now Baltimore, accountability, credibility, transparency. I think, Don, we can agree on all that. Act Now Baltimore. And, of course, you can always find Reverend Al Hathaway out at unionbaptistmd.org. A man about town and a good man. We really appreciate the visits. We always learn a lot when we speak with you, Rev. Appreciate you.
Thank you. Take care. Have a great day now.
You got it. Don Moeller joining us here, former Baltimore County executive, as always. And I think everybody here is eating Taharka ice cream. So I'm going to hold up a little chocolate love and give some appreciation to our friends at Taharka for sponsoring us. Also, our friends at Fadley's. Make sure you're getting a crab cake. You can ship those crab cakes anywhere in the world from Fadley's. Do it on their website. You can also curbside some takeaway right now if you wish. Don and I have done both things. And not to mention State Fair. We got to throw a shout out for Evan. He has the big tent. They have social distancing now. And across the street, he's opening up a Mexican restaurant. I can smell the fajitas from here. Last shout out goes to Jeff Mahler and Mahler and Gary Realty. Don's son, selling homes, buying homes, listing homes, and doing it during COVID and afterward here into the summer. You can list it and show it virtually online. He's been selling homes like we've not had a coronavirus around here. Make sure you find them at Mahler and Gary Realty. Big appreciation to all of you. We're now 250 episodes deep. Whew. And still plenty more to say here at Baltimore Positive. I am Nestor. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Mahler, we are WNST.net, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore. We're keeping calm, we're staying local, and we're always Baltimore Positive.